Welcome to night 18 of the 1001 Nights podcast. Each episode, we bring you the ancient mythologies of the Arabian Nights as reinterpreted by modern authors. This week, we feature the story of The Mistress of the House by Maggie Lehrman. The stories are famously told by Scheherazade to enrapture the Sultan in a heroic effort to forestall her execution and save her people. In case you need a reminder, Cole the Porter had found himself the guest of three rich and beautiful women. They partied through the night with strange guests when the three women started acting very bizarrely. Cole's curiosity got the better of him, and he asked them about their behavior, only to find himself on the wrong side of a gun. Eventually, the other guests were able to convince the women to let them leave unharmed. When they left, however, it was revealed that two of the guests were actually investigators, and they brought the woman in for questioning. The mistress of the house had started to tell her story, explaining that her father owned a successful space exploration company, when morning had dawned and Scheherazade ceased to tell her tale. But the Sultan so badly wanted to know the end of the story that he had allowed Scheherazade to live another day, and so we find them together on the 18th night. Scheherazade lies beside the Sultan in their grand bed. A single candle flickers lazily, casting echoes of the intricate carvings in the mahogany onto the rich cloth trappings that hang down all around them.
Shall I continue to tell you the story of Cole the Porter and the ladies of Baghdad, my love?
The Sultan smiled and nodded, for he had come to look forward to these stories in the dark of the night. And so, Scheherazade, also smiling softly, began.
I'd been a couple of years out of school when our father died, and I was already working at the company he built. My next youngest sister, Rowena, was a sophomore in college. But before too long, she dropped out. Studying seemed pointless with her third of the inheritance to spend. The youngest sister, McKenna, never bothered to apply to college at all. They moved to the city together and convinced me to buy out their shares of the company. "Don't you want to have a purpose?" I asked them. "Don't you want to contribute?" "Dad wouldn't want us messing up his business," Rowena said. "You're so much smarter than we are, Brianna," Mackenzie said. I did not understand my sisters, but I loved them, and they convinced me that they would be happier living off the money that had already been made rather than working for more. So I bought out their shares and became the majority owner of my father's fleet. With the money, they found apartments and furnished them stylishly. They bought identical tiny dogs that they carried in matching designer purses. They sent me pictures at first to show how they were enjoying their fortune. When I did not respond, what does one say to a tiny dog in a sailor suit standing on a $5,000 couch? They stopped. Around that time, our R&D group managed to crack the faster-than-light problem. We'd been inching toward light speed for decades, but now that we had it, entire worlds and incredible vistas opened up for exploration. The solution had something to do with localized black holes, dark matter, and the residue of nuclear explosions, but I never really understood the details and didn't have to. Like my father in the early days, I knew what it meant in a larger sense. We had an incredible opportunity. I lost touch with my sisters during this period of discovery when the fleet sent its first ships beyond where human beings had ever traveled before. The other executives and I waited and watched the black, hoping for reports of new worlds. I did not think to look at the world around me, not at the men and women who were my colleagues and could have been my friends or lovers, not at the distant city where my sisters spent their inheritances and pampered their dogs, not even at the mail piling up inside my front door or the unread emails in my inbox. So I nearly missed Rowena's wedding, only discovering the invite the week before the date. I chartered the jet. Rowena looked beautiful. McKenna was her maid of honor. I felt out of place. Even the dogs had important roles to play, yipping their way up the aisle with a ring around each tidy neck while I sat alone in the back. Rowena's fiancé seemed to me a person with almost no experience with people, as a particularly repulsive slug, dressed in a designer suit, but I figured it was too late to register any familial objections. McKenna's boyfriend wasn't so much a slug as a viper, flat black eyes and all. But they both seemed happy, and again, I didn't feel it was my place to advise them. Still, I was glad to get back to my home and the fleet, and when McKenna's wedding invitation came a few months later, I buried it under the rest of the mail and pretended I had never gotten it. Several years later, after a number of successful trial runs that had established new trade routes, our interstellar business was booming. I decided to go with one of the ships, heading for a distant planet our scientists predicted would be hospitable for life, in hopes of establishing a colony or mining operation. My father never had the opportunity to participate in space travel. Not that he didn't want to, but I think he felt a responsibility to my mother and then to myself and my sisters, and he didn't want to take the risk. But I had no children or boyfriend, not even a dog. I wanted to see the black. Months before the planned launch date, Rowena and McKenna appeared on my doorstep, looking too thin and ragged around the edges. The dogs seemed subdued in their arms, their hair matted and heads slumped against their owners' chests in defeat, their expensive clothes wilted and wrinkled in the Florida heat. "Mark left me for his dental hygienist," Rowena said. "Evan's in jail," McKenna said. Neither of them had any of their inheritance left. I was stunned that together four people could spend that much money. But they told me I didn't understand the way their lives worked, which was fair. I didn't. "We need a place to stay for a while," Rowena said. "Just to get back on our feet," Mackenzie said. "Perfect," I said. "You can stay here while I'm on my trip." Rowena and McKenna looked at each other. So did the dogs. "What trip?" I told them about the voyage, and to my surprise, they said they wanted to come too. Normally, this wouldn't be allowed. They had no training or skills, and they no longer owned a part of the company that our father had built. But I talked to the board and got them to say yes. I had earned a certain amount of respect for my fair-mindedness and dedication. I never asked for favors for myself or anyone else. I think the board agreed more out of surprise than anything else. Even then, I didn't truly think my sisters would be able to get through the astronaut boot camp, which was grueling. But they weathered every test and stuck around, and I found myself proud of my sisters, for the first time in a very long time. The small, sentimental part of myself felt like this was the right thing to do. All three of us setting off together as a family. Our launch happened on schedule, exactly as we practiced. The ship's preparation, the protocols, the planning, the heat and noise and light of liftoff, the first glimpse of Earth from the black, a rapidly shrinking blue marble. The calculations, the plotting, the weighing of the risks, the stretched out jelly feeling of faster than light, your tongue too big for your mouth, your skin too loose on your bones. The days it took to readjust after we slowed down. Everyone floating from their berths, half-drunk, bumping into walls and gulping down instant coffee. Finally, we felt ourselves enough to watch the planet we were orbiting. Green and silver. Friendly enough, but strange. My sisters and I crowded around the same window with our coffees and laughed at the sight. "It's got potential," Rowena said. "It's not a total dump," McKenna agreed. "It's perfect," I said. We three, plus a crew of four others, an explorer, a scientist, an expert in colonization, and a mineral specialist, formed the first landing party. We picked a clear, flat spot and descended in a pod while the ship remained in orbit. As we approached, one stunning fact became clear. This planet was occupied. Or at least, it had been. We didn't see any movement, but we saw, to our amazement, pyramids and dwellings, steps carved from stone and bridges over their silver lakes, our landing spot appeared to be the town square. After a moment of awed silence, the explorer began arguing that we should return to the ship immediately. It may not have been prudent, but I could not resist being the first person to venture onto an inhabited planet, and maybe even meet its alien residents. I made the final decision to land and disembark. Up close, the city was even more beautiful and strange than it seemed from the air. The silver rivers ran all through the squares in tiny channels. Huge structures with doors twice the size of the tallest human lined the square. The building material looked like sand, and when poked with the mineral specialist's tools, sparkling flakes floated through the air. I could see the excitement on his face as he contemplated a potential new resource. My sisters grew fascinated by the sculptures lining the square, as tall as the doorways, which appeared to be carved from black stone. They had faces and bodies and limbs in recognizable places, but they were not human. Rowena stared up at their faces while McKenna dug in the dirt around their feet. I found myself drawn to the largest pyramid at the end of the square. The stillness of this place and the blue-orange quality of the light made me feel as if I were walking in a dream. I climbed the stairs, 87 of them, letting loose clouds of sand with every step. At the top, there were more stone statues, grander and more formidable than the ones down in the square. I saw what must have entranced McKenna, what appeared to be scraps and pieces of gold around their feet, like offerings. Of course, it might not have been gold at all, but it looked so much like it, I couldn't blame McKenna for her interest. But I was not here for gold. I kept walking through the cavernous rooms filled with strange furniture, and everywhere those stone statues keep watching. The place was not a ruin, but where had the occupants gone? And why? Finally, I came to a much smaller door with a recognizable hand-sized doorknob. I hesitated only for a moment, and in that moment seemed to feel the stone statue staring at my back, waiting for me to decide. Then I opened the door. A man sat in a small room. He seemed like a man, at least to me. He looked up when I entered. His face was perfect. His smile shone. My breath caught in my throat. I did not know what to do with my hands. I forgot the ship and the statues and my sisters and the black. I could only see this man, a perfect, the most beautiful. His hair was black and straight, did I mention? His skin a dark brown. I could see myself in his eyes, and he was as happy to see me as I was to see him. I remembered to breathe. "Hello," I said. "Hello," he said, in English, or it sounded like English. I do not understand so much of what happened between us. I can only tell you what I saw and how I felt. It is not scientific, and I will never know the why or the how. "My name is Brianna. I'm from very far away." He nodded. "I am also from far away. My name is Vor." My heart beat wildly. I couldn't tell if it was the fact that I was conversing with an alien, or if it was because I was conversing with Vor. "May I ask how you came to be in this uninhabited place?" Vor's features drew into an expression of confusion, and then some alarm.
"What makes you say this place is uninhabited?"
"We have seen nothing but statues here except for you, of course." Vor stood suddenly and reached for my hand warmed to the pressure.
"We must leave immediately, Brianna."
"Why?" I asked, but I was already running alongside him, hand in hand through the grand rooms.
"Because those are not statues."
Indeed, as we fled, I noticed that the statues had not stayed exactly where I'd left them, and the expressions on their faces had grown warlike. I convinced myself I could feel them moving behind me, but every time I glanced back, they seemed as still as ever, only slightly closer.
"We must go,"
Vor said gently, pulling my attention back to our run. We leapt down the steps of the pyramid together and over the silver streams of the square, and I signaled for the rest of the crew to meet me by the pod. Rowena and McKenna came last, arms full of gold. They stopped suddenly when they saw Vor. He shook his head.
"You do not take their treasure. They will be unhappy."
I turned to my sisters. "You heard him. Drop it." They glared at us both and didn't move. I said, "Drop it. We're leaving now." Reluctantly, they put the gold back on the dusty ground and joined us in the pod. Everyone had questions for Vor on the pod ride back to the ship. Where was he from? How did he get there? What were those statues? Did he know how they made their buildings? What was he? Vor smiled pleasantly and answered what he could. Far away. He didn't remember. The statues were the lords of this planet. He didn't know how they made buildings. He didn't know what he was. I didn't notice, until we docked and disembarked, that he was still holding my hand. My sisters huffed off to their berths without speaking to me. Vor stayed near as I took off my spacesuit. The other crew members stayed away. They found him strange, I could tell, and too mysterious for their scientific minds. They did not see what I saw. I knew that bringing Vor to Earth would be an incredible, newsworthy moment, and that our stock would rise, and that we'd learn so much about the world beyond our borders. But I had stopped caring about all of that the moment I saw him. When I was in my jumpsuit, he took my hand again, this time in both of his. His skin was smooth and cool. My heartbeat jumped in my palm, and he brought it to his lips and kissed it.
"You'll take care of me?" he asked.
I nodded. "And you'll take care of me too," I said. Who can say why they did what they did? I can never ask them. I can only guess. Maybe they saw Vor as a threat to their own security. Maybe they were jealous of his closeness to me. Maybe they wanted to claim the glory of our journey for themselves. Maybe they showed up on my doorstep with this plan in place. My voyage wasn't a secret. They could have known much more than they had said. I wonder. I never understood them. I never really tried to understand them. In the middle of the night, an alarm blared, and I unstrapped from my bed hangings. I went first for Vor. Together, we wound through the ship's cramped hallways to the source of the alarm. An airlock. Through the window, I could see a broken bit of paneling hanging loose on the outside of the ship. Other than the alarm, the ship was strangely quiet. We saw no other crew members. I knew there was no time to waste. A loose panel would become much worse very quickly. I strapped on one of the suits in the panel beside the airlock door, and Vor did the same. I put a hand on his upper arm. "I can do this myself," I said.
"Yes, and I'll go with you," he said.
Together we opened the airlock and stepped out into the black. It's different than being on Earth or any other planet. It's different than being inside a ship. It's the cold press of nothing in every direction, almost against your skin, and the dizzying lights of stars flashing in the corners of your eyes. The panel was only loose. It took a quick shove to put it back into place. I signaled for Vor to follow me back into the airlock. But before we reached the door, our lines went slack. We had been cut loose from inside the airlock. Not only our thick metal tethers, but also the thinner safety backup wire. I could see the jagged ends of the wires floating in front of my eyes. Someone, or two someones, had gone after the wires with a serrated knife. We were traveling the same speed as the ship, no resistance, so even cut loose, all we had to do was reach out for the handholds and drag ourselves into the airlock. But in the seconds it took to process the necessary life-saving step, a blast of air from the ship shoved us backwards. Some were salting relentlessly, and the ship shot away from us. Leaving us in the still black, alone. Ah, but I see the light of dawn is now sneaking its way into the palace, and my execution is nearly at hand. I suppose you'll never know what became of the ladies of Baghdad, or Cole the Porter.
But the Sultan so desired to hear the end of the tale that he allowed Scheherazade to live that dawn, so she may finish her tale the following night. The 1001 Nights podcast is produced by Morgan Dubin and me, Nathan Kane. Scheherazade is played by the incredibly talented Arielle Siegel. The story of the Mistress of the House is written by Maggie Lehrman. Maggie Lehrman is a writer and editor living in Brooklyn, New York. The Chicago Tribune called her novel The Cost of All Things a cleverly layered debut. She grew up outside of Chicago and went on to get a degree in English at Harvard. During her decade of working as an editor of books for children, she also earned an MFA in writing for children and young adults from Vermont College of Fine Arts. Visit her online at maggielehrman.com or on Twitter at Maggie Lehrman. The story of Cole the Porter and the Ladies of Baghdad was written by Marissa Dobson. The music on the 1001 Nights podcast is generously contributed by Hey Van Lara Lemmy, Pharaoh's Daughter, and Eric Hopton. To find out more about the 1001 Nights podcast, visit us online at 1001nightspodcast.com. To celebrate the completion of a big project this week, we gave our small staff $100 and sent them out to get coffee for the group. When they came back, I asked for the change, only to discover there was none.
I was stunned that together 4 people could spend that much money. But they told me I didn't understand the way their lives worked.
All I could get out of them were the 2 words, cold brew. All right, that will do it for night 18 of the 1001 Nights podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and good morning.